The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly with me, Alex Kratosky. On this week's show,
it's a really difficult question, I think, and you have to figure out yourself who to trust. And in some cases, so when you say the government, for instance, you might trust some parts of the government, but not other parts.
Web pioneer Daniel Applequist meets The Guardian's Jemima Kish to discuss why advances in the current web standards are as important as faster broadband, and why net security should concern us all. Also, we look at trouble in the Facebook camp, including an IP scrap over their newly purchased virtual reality headset, the Oculus Rift. And the Facebook account hackers, who hacked themselves. Not very clever, folks. Also, Tesco got it right with their Huddle own brand tablet, so watch out for their next adventure in devices, an own brand smartphone. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Joining me from The Guardian's tech desk are Alex Hearn.
Hi, hello.
Hi, Alex. And Samuel Gibbs. Say hi, Sam.
Hello.
Oh, very good. Very, very excitable. Hello, gentlemen. It's lovely to see you here in basically the Starship Enterprise in the center of Guardian Towers, isn't it? We've got a beautiful view over pretty
sunny,
much
sunny
observation
place.
Deck.
Yeah, exactly. Over everybody. It's almost as if we're spying on them. Anyway, first up, let's turn to a number of interesting developments on planet Zuckerberg. Facebook are finding that their new puppy, the virtual reality headset development company Oculus Rift, comes with some baggage. Alex, you wrote this up. Tell us more.
Okay, so basically it all goes back to the summer of 2012. Oculus was still very much in the planning stages. It was not much more than a glint in Palmer Luckey's eye. Slightly more, maybe. They did have prototypes and stuff. But Palmer Luckey was basically touring the gaming scene with this idea and this prototype of a fully immersive virtual reality headset that did head tracking so that you could look around and see what you were doing. And amongst the people he showed it to was John Carmack, who is probably the most famous sort of gaming coder in the world. He coded Doom. This is his claim to fame.
I know it's his claim to fame, but you know what? Doom was a long time ago.
It was a long time ago. He's since then, I mean, the thing about being a coder rather than a designer, of course, is that naturally you tend to hang back a bit.
He doesn't though. He's got a really flashy car. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But so he's still at ID, he was until recent events, was still at ID. He had been working on Doom 3, and he was so impressed by the Oculus that one of the things that he started doing was working on code that would make Doom 3 work with the Oculus. In the end, that partnership was so successful that one of the things that the Oculus Kickstarter, which launched in August 2012, promised was an edition of Doom 3 that was modified to work with the Oculus Rift when it shipped to backers. Fast forward 18 months, Oculus made $2.5 million in its Kickstarter and then sold for $2 billion to Facebook. And ZeniMax, the owners of ID Software, who Carmack was working for when he developed the Doom 3 BFG edition for the Oculus, ZeniMax has suddenly wondered, well, to hear it from their point of view, they suddenly wondered whether all of this work that John Carmack put into the Oculus Rift will pay off for them.
Well, absolutely, because it was developed on their time.
To hear it from John Carmack's point of view, ZeniMax has suddenly gone, this dude who used to work for us is now making a lot more money elsewhere. We want a slice of that pie.
But hold on a second. He's making if he called it Doomy or Doomé or Boom, then perhaps, but you know, we have a pretty straightforward intellectual property thing. I mean, if ZeniMax and ID were the people for whom Doom was being prepared,
Doom has stayed with them. Oculus have no Doom. Doom 3 BFG is now not being shipped for the Oculus. So John Carmack is saying that there is not a single line of code he wrote in his ZeniMax time which is now included in the Oculus software. He didn't have anything to do with the hardware, and that, as he puts it, ZeniMax do not own VR. It looks like it's one of those things that could run and run, but at the same time, the fact that ZeniMax haven't actually launched legal proceedings does perhaps indicate that they were hoping to get lucky. My gut feeling is that they were trying to get some cash and that Oculus have hit back slightly harder than they thought they would.
And would this have any effect on Facebook's plans for the Oculus?
Probably not. I mean, the worst case scenario for Facebook is that they have to shell out a bit more money than they had previously expected. But like I say, I don't even think that's likely. I think given quite how vehemently Carmack and Oculus have denied that there is anything that ZeniMax owns, including the Oculus software, I'd be surprised if ZeniMax push it much further.
Well, other Facebook news this week, F8 has been happening, which is the Facebook's network meeting. It's a big conference that happens every year. And there's some really interesting stuff that's come out. Samuel, you've been writing about Facebook's anonymous logins. Tell me a little bit more about that. Does that mean that I can log in as somebody who's anonymous? Because frankly, isn't that ultimately completely contradictory to what Facebook does?
Sadly not.
Ah.
Facebook still tracks you. Facebook knows who you are. Its anonymous login is designed more for the what are called federated identities, using your Facebook to log into something else, another app, for instance, like Flipboard. Currently, as it stands, every time you log into an app through Facebook, the app will gain some of your Facebook information, and that could be as much or as little as is the deal between yourself, Facebook, and the app. You didn't have a lot of control over that until now. The new anonymous logins effectively allow you to log into an app but not actually share any information whatsoever, not even your name. It is just a token to identify you as some ID number.
Well, somebody who, what, wants to try the thing out for a little bit, or is
so,
that...
So the... it was pitched as a way to try out an app before, try before you buy, effectively. Try out before sharing your information. But if you really didn't want to share your information, you don't have to. The app can see you as a token and therefore can track you as a user around the app, so it can save your personal preferences, for instance, et cetera, et cetera. It just doesn't have any of your personal information from Facebook.
So that's how it's being pitched at me, the user. I can imagine that there's a lot of developers who rely upon all of the information that your traditional non-anonymous login to their app provides. How has this been pitched to the developers?
Well, put it this way, I think it's more of a, here, look, they can try your app and they'll love it. And then you can get all the information, you know. People won't be put off for logging into your app in the first place.
Are people put off from logging into an app in the first place?
Well, put it this way,
I know I am.
Really?
Yeah.
But you're switched on to this kind of thing. Are most people even aware that when they log in?
My guess is that there's a strong element of once bitten, twice shy. That the first time you see something kind of cool, log into it, and it hijacks your account, post spam. A lot of people come out of that and are just like, no, I'm not ever doing anything on my Facebook again. And they mean it, because for a lot of people, the advantage of giving an app access to your Facebook account is probably kind of minimal. Facebook really won't, you know, every time that happens is a disaster for them, winning back that level of trust.
I mean, F8 this year was all about empowering the user to have control. It was a change shift from Mark Zuckerberg's policy on privacy, it basically not being there, to a matured company where it judges privacy as one of the more important aspects of having a Facebook account. So this is one step in that chain of upgrade of your privacy settings. I mean, once you have chosen to share your information with an app, you can also change by a line-by-line basis what is shared by the app. So, you know, you've now got three stages. You can share everything, you can go completely anonymous, or you can modify it just enough. So, yeah, it's Facebook maturing as a company.
Interesting. Well, it is a little bit more about transparency, but of course, I'm sure listeners, long-term listeners to this program, recognize, even short-term listeners, given that we have talked about exactly this topic not in the not-too-distant past, recognize the irony of the fact that Facebook Facebook's F8 Network Summit this year was about the user. But quickly, speaking of the Facebook user, there are some people who are feeling a little bit dumb at the minute, aren't there? Samuel, what happened? People are hacking themselves.
Yes.
That's pretty clever.
Yeah, it really is. People are again falling for a scam that first came up in about 2011. Paste this code into your browser console, which is a developer function of a console, so you have to be going some to get there anyway, and you will be able to see your friends' passwords. A little bit too good to be true, perhaps, and indeed it was. In fact, all it does is run a load of actions like following accounts, liking things, posting things on your own Facebook account. And the cunning thing is that the scammers say, paste this in and wait 2 hours because then it will reveal the passwords. It's just like...
And how many people did this?
Well, quite a few. We don't know exact numbers. And this, like I said, the scam found success in 2011 initially, and by all accounts managed to impact 50,000 people back then. This has been re-engineered and targeted at Indians, and we know that because the pages that they're forced to like are of Indian origin, and it's targeting people who essentially don't know what they're doing.
Well, they know enough, though, don't they, to get into a development console?
Yeah, so essentially it's like, look at this document. It'll describe in step-by-step, easy-to-do instructions. So the first instruction is open the developer console. Second instruction is paste this in, and then away you go. And, I mean, Facebook knows about this.
This type of hack has been a problem for a while, and it was about 8 months ago, Facebook gently disabled the console for certain browsers because they were just like, okay, you know what? There are too many idiots in the world for us to deal with this.
So it's the Facebook nanny yeah. state. But actually, I was amused by the reverse psychology of their system of dissuading people, because didn't they publish a quote that says, allow my account to be hijacked if I paste malicious JavaScript? That's brilliant.
Yeah. You'd have to be a fool to check that box.
Well, apparently there are some of us amongst possibly even in this room, I couldn't possibly say, who themselves are fools. But anyway, for all the latest on Facebook, just go to theguardian.com/technology. And if we've piqued your interest and you want to hear our voices talking about Facebook, we have several Facebook tech weeklies that we've done relatively recently. You can hear Jemima Kish speaking with Sheryl Sandberg, and you can also hear our coverage of Facebook at 10. Tesco made a foray into technology last year, launching its own brand low-cost tablet, and it was met with critical approval from our own Samuel Gibbs. Sam, you're nodding with raised eyebrows as if you are being critical and yet approving. Sam, was this grudging acceptance from you, or was it the delight of the masses that spurred the company on to further explore devices?
Does Tesco really care what I think?
I don't know.
Probably not. It only really cares about numbers, and it did well. In the first 3 months, it sold 300,000 Huddle tablets, and it genuinely couldn't keep stock on the shelves. It was going as fast as it could pump them out. And I think it kind of caught Tesco by surprise by just how many people wanted this thing. And then it hit 550,000 units recently, according to Phil Clark, their Tesco's chief executive. So yeah, it did well. I mean,
remind us what the Huddle is. It's a tablet, handheld machine, computer, touchscreen, like the iPad, like a Galaxy, like many of us recognize, but it's stripped back, isn't it?
Yes, it's essentially it's a budget tablet. It's a cheap tablet. But the way that Tesco cleverly managed to create this thing was that it was low cost in the fact that it could be acquired for under 120 quid with Tesco Club Card vouchers. It got for I think it was 60 quid's worth of Club Card vouchers, which is absolute bargain. But it was pretty good. You know, I mean, it wasn't spectacular. It wasn't an iPad,
But it was much better than most of the tablets that cost anywhere near it, including the Argos tablet, which came later and was made it look like the Rolls-Royce of tablets.
And we covered both of them in the run-up to Christmas because we accurately predicted that this would be the tablet Christmas. It's amazing the Guardian has such facilities to do that. Okay, so now we have the success with the tablet with Tesco, and that obviously got the saliva flowing because they were like, okay, let's see what else we can do. This device lark is a bit fun, seems to be quite easy. Let's build a smartphone. What are the rumors around this?
So Phil Clark, again, Tesco CEO, got on the radio and said they were making a smartphone and it will be available by the end of this year.
And do you think that the developers inside, whoever it is who's building these devices, went, what? Or, hooray, we've got more work. I mean, what do you think? Was this an accidental Diane Abbott announcing her running for leader of the party kind of thing? Or was this a bit more, was there precursors?
I think there were precursors. There's another Huddle tablet coming out in September. So the pipeline is still going, the Huddle 2 or whatever they end up calling it. At the end of the year, that's a long enough time that even if they hadn't got things going quite yet, they probably got enough time to actually design it and build it.
Are they aiming to go for people who currently are on feature phones, haven't made that leap, so perhaps don't know the quality of high-end smartphones? Or are they looking to convert people from other smartphone markets?
That's a very good question, and one I put to Tesco, but they wouldn't budge. So original comments were around the fact that it was going to be competing with high-end phones. As it turns out, what they really mean is the best available smartphones. Now, what does that mean? That's a very good question. I don't really know what the best available smartphones is. If you're talking best on specs, on things like that, that's a whole new raft. I mean, we just had the Samsung Galaxy S5, the HTC One, the Sony Xperia Z2, literally just released in the last month or so. Those are the best, but I don't know whether Tesco's targeting those. I have a feeling it's going to be more along the kind of lines of the Motorola Moto G, which was a great budget smartphone with arguably a better experience than anything in its price bracket, anything in there. Or the Google Nexus 5, which again is a flagship phone, but it's only £300. So I think it's going to be more in that range, the kind of like mid-range.
Alex?
In the absence of Charles, I'll make two points which I think he would want us to cover here.
Thank goodness for that. We are channeling you, Charles, wherever you may be.
The first is that if Tesco are targeting the people who are still using feature phones, that is a rapidly shrinking market. And it's also a market which is, by its very nature, extremely unwilling to switch. People who are still on feature phones, by and large, I don't think anymore they are the people who can't afford to switch to smartphones. They're the people who actively do not want to. And so coming in and undercutting other smartphones, there will still be a few people who genuinely, that it is price keeping them away. But on contract, smartphones are free now. On a lot of pay-as-you-go packages, smartphones are genuinely pocket money prices. If Tesco is going after that market, it's questionable, which means that actually, given Tesco seem to be extremely smart about this, that's probably not the market they're going after. But the other point that I think Charles would make is that the low-end tablet market is very, very interesting, because what it actually is competing with isn't really things like iPads. It's things like the little TVs that you can buy to put in the kitchen and watch while you're cooking. What low-end tablets are very, very cheap screens, which it's easy to get media onto. That's a really important thing in people's lives, but expertise in that area doesn't necessarily translate to expertise in the sort of all-purpose, slick and easy computing model that you need to have for a smartphone. And I think that's going to be the thing that Tesco really have to struggle with, even though the Huddle actually is good at that as well.
I wanted to throw one more thing out here, Samuel, and that is Tesco has a presence across Europe, right? And so to what degree is this linked specifically to a UK market? I know that there is a relationship between the smartphone or the idea, the rumors around the smartphone and Tesco's own banking system. And certainly Amazon is also playing around with the idea of having a smartphone as well. So we're starting to see those pipeline phenomena. But to what degree is this going to be only for the UK market?
We don't know yet. I think it's likely to be focused, I mean, on the UK. The tablet can now go outside the UK. They proved that it works in the UK. The UK is one of the most competitive markets out there, both for tablets and for smartphones. I think it would be sensible to test it here, see what happens, and then roll it out further. The beauty about operating it here is Tesco has its own mobile network in the UK. It is an MVNO, operates on O2, and so it's likely to be sold through Tesco Mobile. Outside the UK, it doesn't have that kind of facility. So I have a feeling it's going to be a UK-focused thing from the start.
You can follow all of the smartphone news, including that which is written by Charles and not just channeled through us, from Charles at theguardian.com/technology. And finally, the truth is out there on the internet. This week, digital citizenry was captivated by a mysterious YouTube account that's been uploading 10-second clips of red and blue rectangles just flashing in front of your eyes at a rate of 1 every 20 seconds. Not the rectangles, the videos are going up 1 every 20 seconds, to the tune of more than 77,000 videos. Our own Alex Hearn has been playing the roles of both Mulder and Scully in trying to decode what WebDriver Torso is up to. Alex, describe this thing for me. Maybe I can figure it out from afar.
So yeah, I mean, 80,000 videos, each one of which is identical in many aspects. They all have in the bottom left-hand corner the word aqua.flv, which is presumably the name of the file. They all have a short alphanumeric string as a name, and they all show 10 frames of a red and a blue rectangle, sometimes overlapping, sometimes separate, accompanied by 10 pitches, various whistles, essentially. Dee, 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 dee. I mean, it's very, very close Encounters of the Third
Kind. Yeah, I was going to say. So is this why people think that it's aliens coming down? This is fantastic.
Nobody knows what it is. I first heard about it on Twitter, and then various subreddits were devoted to it.
Unsurprisingly.
One of the reasons why it's so compelling is that there's no clue. That, like, normally when you find weird artifacts on the internet, they aren't so regimented. Oddness is normally vaguely chaotic, and chaos normally has little hints, little trails leading off which you can follow. On this, there was at first nothing, genuinely no obvious lead to follow. The only thing that we had was the name WebDriver Torso, and that leads down some rabbit holes.
As I say, you've been donning the old Baker Street hat and, you know, smoking your pipe, and I mean, you've been going down those rabbit holes.
But before you pull at the thread, there were theories that people had. My favorite one is that it's a 21st century version of a numbers station, this old Cold War relic where a long-wave radio mast would be broadcasting at irregular intervals random numbers.
They still exist.
They still exist, and they are creepy as hell to listen
amazing,
to.
Yeah, they're amazing, aren't they? Oh, I love them.
And so it could have been that. It could well be that, and you could imagine sending a spy saying sort of, oh, video number 42,573 is your decoder ring for today. Place these rectangles over this document. Or something.
Yeah, exactly. Le chapeau et bleu. You know what I mean? Now the people out there listening in SOE land know exactly what I'm talking about. But yeah, absolutely. It's full of intrigue, isn't
it? Yeah, it could so easily have been that.
But?
The name itself, the first thread that you pull at is rather more prosaic. WebDriver is basically a part of an open source browser testing suite called Selenium. It lets you automate browsers. In other words, if you were trying to build a piece of software which did something like upload 77,000 videos at 20-second intervals, you would use WebDriver to do it. So that thread was a dead end, essentially. You hit it and it was like, oh, okay, the first part of the name at least comes from the software that was used to make it. This is nothing. The more interesting hints were two anomalous videos, one of which you can only find if you set your account to French and go back to the very beginning, before they uploaded any WebDriver videos. there was an episode of Aqua Teen Hunger Force, the Cartoon Network comedy, which you could pay €1.99 to watch. That was uploaded. Quite why, I do not know, but it was there. And then the other French Connection, about 1,000 videos in, so already we're talking you have to go back to the start, and then you have to click more videos, until you get bored, and then you have to keep on clicking it until you get bored a second time, and then eventually you find, 1,000 videos in, a six-second video of the Eiffel Tower, which has one comment underneath by WebDriver Torso, the only text that the uploader has entered anywhere on the internet, which says something like, Mate is a genius. So we have a name, Mate. Unfortunately...
Oh, this is why you become a journalist, isn't
Mate,
it? This is amazing.
Mate is a really common Romanian first and surname.
Oh, no.
And so the stage I'm at right now is five Mates who I've sent out emails to going, hi, you work in a realm that is either image recognition or automation or robot vision, anything which might theoretically lead to you needing to upload 77,000 videos. None of them have got back to me. In the meantime, I've got some lovely emails from readers suggesting Google collusion. One of them thinks that because the Aqua Teen Hunger Force episode was uploaded before Google did official, paid downloads, that it must be a Google testing account. Google aren't speaking either. Then there's aliens.
Because of course there's aliens.
At this stage, I will believe anything.
It's absolutely it's dramatic. It's exciting. It's got twists. It's got turns. It's got those slightly random things that just jump in the middle. Is the truth out there? Or do you think that this is just literally an artifact of the fact that we are seeing behind the curtain? We're seeing what's going on underneath, you know, behind the veil.
I have a feeling that in about 3 or 4 days, some confused researcher in a technical college in France is going to open up their Gmail account and go, what? What's happened?
Oh, sacrebleu.
Oh, I left the uploader on. Sorry, guys.
Amazing. Well, if you happen to have any theories, then please do let us know at tech@theguardian.com and Alex will sift through them for clues. Oh, this is brilliant. This is going to occupy you for a long time. This is... Are you doing any other work? Because this is a rabbit hole I would find myself just going down. It's wonderful.
I want to know the truth.
It's out there. But yes, please do send us an email at tech@theguardian.com if you yourself have any theories or in fact are linked to the mystery. Daniel Appelquist is a mobile and web industry veteran, a pioneer of the early web. He now works as an open web advocate for Telefonica Digital, which is the innovation arm inside Telefonica, the parent company of O2. Daniel is also a member of the web consortium W3C, led by Tim Berners-Lee, seeking to create a forward-looking international standard for web programming languages. Daniel came into The Guardian recently to give a talk on the state of web protocols, net security, and the arrival of a new generation of standards that will make the web work better, now and in the future. Head of technology at The Guardian, Jemima Kish, spoke with Daniel to find out more.
Daniel Appelquist joins us today. He's open web advocate at Telefonica. Welcome to the pod.
Thank you very much.
Now, you do all sorts of things in your job. You work with the IETF and the W3C. What do those acronyms mean for lay people?
So first of all, I should say that I work in what we call the Open Web Devices team within Telefonica, and a lot of the focus there is on Firefox OS, which is the project that I'm kind of focusing on. Firefox OS is a phone operating system that's built on top of web standards, and that's the reason that I'm kind of working with organizations in the web standards ecosystem and the internet standards ecosystem to drive forward a lot of new technologies that are required for that for that project, and in general are looking at kind of new technologies in the web and the internet. The W3C is the World Wide Web Consortium. We abbreviate World Wide Web as W3. It's kind of a very geeky thing to do, but that is the organization that was set up by Tim Berners-Lee. Actually, we are in the 20th anniversary year of W3C, and by some accounts, the 25th anniversary of the web, as you may be aware.
Well, happy birthday on both counts.
Yes.
there are very many technical standards and a lot of very complex technical negotiations that go on in both of those organizations. But ultimately, your challenge is to make ordinary people know and care and understand how this affects their digital life. But how do you do that? Because the public are notoriously disinterested in their own security online.
Well, when we're talking about security and privacy, I think this is an area where there's increasing public awareness, and partially due to reporting in by organizations like The Guardian. So, when people hear about monitoring of their communication, or when they hear about more commercially focused stories around data privacy, people are starting to become aware of the digital footprint that they're leaving. But they're left with a lot of anecdotal information about how to deal with that and what they should be looking for and how they should be understanding that their communications are secure. So that's a challenge. And a lot of the communication that people are receiving around these topics comes from companies that are trying to sell them something. So Skype will tell you your communications over Skype are secure, and indeed they are quite secure. But there have been reported that Microsoft is able to decrypt some of that communication. So you don't really know what's happening with Skype. For instance, it's kind of a black box to you. Now, I use Skype all the time, right? I'm not advocating not using Skype, but it's a kind of emblematic of the information that people have about their security is often coming from the products and services that they use, and they're being asked to trust those products and services.
Well, they can't trust the government, can they, because of the Snowden revelations? So who is there to trust? Who do we trust in online security?
It's a really difficult question, I think, and you have to figure out yourself who to trust. And in some cases, so when you say the government, for instance, you might trust some parts of the government, but not other parts. So no organization is a single entity in these days, especially when it comes to the internet. There are organizations like IETF, Internet Engineering Task Force, and W3C that are trying to have a kind of neutral stance and be trusted organizations when it comes to the development of technical standards, but they're not particularly good at putting out communication to lay people, to people that are not technologists.
It's fairly wordy.
Yeah.
It's fairly wordy, yeah, and fairly thick on jargon as well.
I will say that Mozilla, which is the organization that develops Firefox, certainly sees itself as at least partially nonprofit organization, or the overarching structure of Mozilla as a nonprofit organization that is intended to kind of champion the web and web openness and web freedom of expression. So that's that organization, and organizations like it are one place to look. Electronic Frontier Foundation is another place. Again, they tend to be very targeted towards people who are already aware of digital privacy issues or already are working in technology. So people that are aware of Electronic Frontier Foundation are generally technologists, right? We already know about these issues.
It's a shared responsibility, though, isn't it? I mean, there is very poor tech literacy, not just among the public, but in businesses and in government. And it has to be a collaboration between education and government and the technology industry and also the media to get people interested in this, doesn't it?
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think we haven't seen that kind of collaboration happening so far. Or maybe if we've seen it, we've only seen it in very small amounts. I think what's important to understand about the web and the internet is that they are a kind of commons that we use and that we share and that we derive value from. And a lot of companies and organizations that are using the internet, that are on the web, are deriving that value and are providing people products and services over the internet and over the web, and in many cases are putting energy back into the development of those technologies through organizations like W3C and IETF, where companies and organizations participate and drive the next generation of the standards forward that are underlying the web and the internet. But there's no place that you can look to as an end user to hear the voice of the internet community, really. I think Mozilla is one place, maybe, but we need more of that.
So the actual nuts and bolts of online security, we hear a lot about HTTPS, and there will be very many more sites picking up this technology, maybe even The Guardian itself one day, theguardian.com. Why is this so important, and how do you explain this to your mother?
So, for instance, it was very easy for me to explain to a good friend of mine recently why they should be worried about HTTP. This wasn't recent, actually. This was a while ago. This was a few years ago. By using a freely available piece of software, you could actually take a look at traffic that was flying over a public Wi-Fi network. So if you and I were both connected to a public Wi-Fi network and you logged into Facebook or Twitter, then I would be able to take a look at all the traffic flying over the internet. And because it's not encrypted, it's not over HTTPS, and the S stands for secure there, I would be able to pick it apart and actually extract from it the credentials which enable me to impersonate you. So a few years ago, I was at an industry meeting, and I was trying to get across to somebody the importance of this topic. And I actually tweeted as them, you know, not maliciously, but simply to show them how easy it is. Now, since then, we've seen websites like Twitter and Facebook and Google take the lead in terms of being secure only. So when you go to Google, increasingly all Google services are under HTTPS, which means you get the same level of security as you would normally expect, for instance, to talk to your bank from your web browser.
Well, it used to be a security layer that people did associate with their bank and not really with consumer websites, but that's changing,
right?
Obviously.
Well, that was the design. The design criteria for HTTPS were to make people comfortable with spending money online. And this was in the mid to late 90s, and I remember this. There was a lot of energy put out there by the banks in particular because they wanted to move people to online banking. It was seen as a cost-saving measure, certainly. But also it was a differentiator for the banks that were getting into that space, that they could engage customers from, this was in the States, across state lines, and they could get into new business areas, but they needed to convince people that it was secure to do their banking online. And so there was a lot of talk about military-grade encryption and this sort of thing. And we essentially have the same system in place for secure connections that we had back then. It hasn't really been revised that much. There are some new technologies coming out which hopefully add layers of security on top of that. But that really shouldn't be visible to the end user. It should get easier and easier for the end user rather than the user having to worry about, am I secure?
There was a time when the Snowden revelations were coming out and a fairly commonly heard sort of dismissal of that story sometimes for individuals was that, well, I'm not doing anything wrong, so I don't mind being surveilled. Do you think we've moved beyond that now?
I think most thinking people can see the flaws in that argument. Even people who are happy to, you know, with kind of pervasive CCTV cameras in public spaces wouldn't be happy with a CCTV camera in their living room. So once you kind of state it in those terms, I think people start to get and understand the difference between pervasive monitoring of all communications and the lawful powers of government to maintain order and that kind of thing. But yeah, again, that sort of gets into a policy area where I'm not a policy person. I'm more of a technologist.
In your area, HTTP2 is going to be another thing that we're hearing a lot more about. So tell us what it is and why it's significant.
So HTTP2 is something really interesting. There, the HTTP in the URLs that people see on the sides of buses, for instance, means Hypertext Transport Protocol, right? And it's a protocol that was originally designed by Tim Berners-Lee in the early 90s, and it was revised in the late 90s to be HTTP 1.1. That's the version of HTTP that is ubiquitously being used on the web today. It's 2014. HTTP 1.1 was designed for a different internet than we have now. And so that's a completely different set of requirements, really. So HTTP 2 is an attempt to redesign the protocol layer to be more efficient for the modern web, basically, and to provide faster page load. There's a lot of inefficiencies in the way that the web works right now with HTTP 1.1. So the idea is that once we move to HTTP 2, we will start to see a much faster web, even on existing hardware, even on existing networks.
And if we partner that with Secure Layer as well, then does that mean we've got a faster and more secure web?
Right. Well, that is part of the notion behind the fact that Google, who run the Chrome project, and Mozilla, who run the Firefox project, have both stated that they will support HTTP 2 only for HTTPS connections. And part of their reasoning behind that is to use HTTP 2 as a carrot to incentivize website developers and website owners to move to HTTP 2. So there's still a debate about that. HTTP 2 is not a fully cooked technology. It's due to go to what we call last call draft in the standardization world in June. And we hope that it's going to be done by the end of the year. Still a lot that could happen in that space, but certainly a lot of people are linking encrypted or HTTPS connections to the deployment of HTTP 2 and are coming at that from, they think that'll be a positive development.
In 5 years' time, what would you like to see as a kind of a much more, a more standard, in fact? Will there be more widespread understanding and embracing, actually, of security services? Or is there a danger that people are so unwilling to engage with this at the moment that actually we might see a few cyber disasters before people really get to grips with this?
One of the things I'd like to see is that we drive more understanding of end users about how secure their communications are, right? So most web browsers, or modern web browsers, I should say, go out of their way to give you a visual indication in what's called the browser chrome, which is the part of the browser that is outside of the web page that you're looking at. So the part where you actually type in the URL, for instance, or where you see the back and forward buttons, that kind of thing. They go out of their way to put a visual indication there about this is a secure website. And if you click on that visual indication, and sometimes it's a lock icon, sometimes it's simply a highlighted HTTPS part of the URL that you're visiting, you can drill down into the provenance of that security. So, for instance, if you're talking to your bank, you can click on that icon and you can see that the certificate that bank is using was issued to them. And you as a user can verify that you're talking to the person that you think you're talking to. And that's a key design element of HTTPS security, but it's something that most people aren't aware of and they don't really understand. What I hope is that browser makers and kind of the internet community in general, including security activists and kind of more organizations that outreach to users, come up with a better way to explain this so that when we use the web, we have an intuitive understanding of when we're in a secure connection and what that means and who we're talking to, because that should enable more people to feel secure about their communications on the web. And certainly, I think a lot of the news recently, not only about the government issues, but also about data security in a more commercial setting, have put people a little bit ill at ease about what's happening when they communicate online. And we don't want that. We want people to feel secure when they communicate online.
Daniel, thank you very much.
Thank you.
To discover more on W3C and future developments in web standards, go to w3.org. We have a link on theguardian.com/techweekly. And that is all we have for you this week. Please do tweet us your feedback and questions and any solutions to the mystery that Alex has been looking for. What's it called again? The
WebDriver Torso.
WebDriver Torso. Send all this to @GuardianTW on Twitter or tech@theguardian.com. But from me, Alex Kratowski, producer Jason Phipps, and all the tech team, thanks for listening. Bye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.